First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Cubans, both at home and here in the Florida diaspora, demand freedom. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, Cuban Americans living here on the First Coast speak out about protests in their homeland as the country undergoes a grave economic crisis. Get on the line and join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, how one local family talks politics when they don't see eye to eye. We'll listen into a conversation between John Delaney and his son Bill about voting. But first this hour, for the first time in more than 60 years of dictatorship, Cubans are risking it all to demand their freedom. Thousands took to the streets Sunday in the communist island nation, showing they're willing to risk their lives to protest against the reign of President Miguel Díaz-Canel. That included a local protest this weekend at the Jacksonville Landing. Cuba is undergoing a terrible time, a grave economic crisis aggravated by the COVID-19 pandemic and U.S. sanctions. Demonstrators say they want freedom and more economic opportunity. We can't stress enough how rare this kind of protest is in Cuba. Multiple protesters there were arrested by police. They used tear gas to break up some demonstrations. There were some violent clashes as well. The president in Cuba blamed U.S. trade sanctions for the economic misery in the communist-run island. And as I mentioned, local Cuban Americans took to the streets here in Jacksonville over the weekend, holding a demonstration at the Jacksonville Landing site, the former Jacksonville Landing site. We're speaking with two Cuban Americans who live in our area right now as we welcome Chad Dominicis, president and general manager of TU18 Jax TV and TU18Jax.com. Chad, good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you. And also on the line, Mario DeCunto, past chair of the Mayor's Hispanic American Advisory Board. Mario, good morning to you as well.
Good morning. And I'm honored to be called a Cuban, and I am not Cuban, but I am the past chair of the Mayor's Hispanic Board, and I am proud to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, both of you, for being with us. And please give us a call, everyone, as we talk about this. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page is open. Chad, let's begin with you. As you watch these protests unfold over the weekend, what went through your mind? What were your thoughts?
And I said to myself, I said, well, it's about time, but I'm afraid it's not going to go anywhere. But 27 years ago, in 1994, was the first protest of this sort, but it only happened in Havana, in the Malecón, near the water there in the bay. And they quickly moved. Castro was still in power. Back then, Fidel was in power, and moved to quash it, and it didn't spread. But this time it's in a lot of places. It's all over the island. And not only that, this time they're expressing themselves in ways that we have not heard before. I mean, wide, wide open. This really started a few months ago with some artists that were being censored. And well, as always happens in Cuba, when you go against the government, you get put in jail.
Mm-hmm.
For one reason or another, and there's always a convenient excuse. The artist movement grew and more people. And then it's really interesting because this morning on NPR.org, there's a great article about how a hip-hop song, really reggaeton song, started in Havana, is driving these protests. Because the song is a way that the people are expressing what they feel. They need food. They say, no more lies. My people demand freedom. No more doctrines. That's part of the lyric. Patria y vida has become the new slogan. When the communists took over, and I should clear this up a bit, first of all, when Castro first took over, he said he was not a communist. I mean, he vowed he was not a communist. And then when the doors of the United States closed, one of his aides was very close to the Russian government, came along and said, don't worry about it, and opened the door. And then the communists officially think. And then they started what they call intervención, where they would take over the businesses and more and more, and then all of a sudden everything belonged to the state. Ever since, there's been a scarcity of everything in Cuba except for the people who are well-connected.
Right.
And the people are tired.
And the people are tired of it. It's been over 60 years. What about the embargo? A protester walked a couple of weeks ago from South Florida all the way to Washington, D.C., calling for an end to the U.S. embargo. He stopped here in Jacksonville and St. Augustine. President Joe Biden has called on the Cuban government to hear the Cuban people and bring freedom, but he made no move to change the economic sanctions that are in place.
And Melissa, I was going to talk about the, you know, we love to use embargoes in the United States. It's our one-size-fits-all solution to a country that doesn't play ball. And unfortunately, this isn't Iran. Like, Cuba is not threatening us anymore with a military intervention. They haven't, you know, they're not building or collecting, you know, enriching uranium right now. They're starving. We need to use a different type of solution to deal with the problems that we have in Cuba. We can't just use the same kind of solution across the world for different kinds of issues. A lot of people are asking for a military response. I think there was a petition going around internationally to get Cubans around the world to support this, but there's also no cause for a military response at this time either, because we're not being aggressed. Yes, the people are being aggressed, but it just—I don't think a military solution will solve anything at this time, too.
So, Mario, Mario, do you think the U.S. should end the embargo?
Well, I definitely think something needs to happen to help feed these folks, but you know, the problem is that Cuba is going to do everything in their power to hold on they want to hold on to power. You know, they're not going to let go for anything. And, you know, right now it's the people need to act to find another way, a more democratic way to lead this island. And, you know, if we back Cuba into a corner, they'll get scared. And when they get scared, that's going to cloud reason. And things may get even worse for the people. I mean, we saw what happened in Venezuela. In the United States, unfortunately, we didn't act well in Venezuela, and the dictator is still in power.
Still in power.
Nothing has changed.
Chad, what about you? What do you think about U.S. policy towards Cuba?
Well, I'm in my own family, I'm not really the dominating voice. Most Cubans in Miami support the embargo, which is honestly, and like Mario said, it's a failed policy. And it's really something. I mean, I've had major discussions with people in my family about it. But the thing is that, and like Mario said, it's an outdated form. And the effect that it's having is mostly on the people. But actually, the biggest problem is that the people themselves don't have money. They don't. Everything has to be bought in dollars. But yet people don't earn dollars. The government gets supplies from other countries, not just the United States. I had a friend within the government who came to the United States after many years, and he said that every week, ships loaded with stuff would come from Panama and from the Dominican Republic, bringing supplies, skirting the embargo. But still, there's a lot of emotion involved here. I worked in Miami radio many years, and I worked with some gentlemen who made their living out of stoking fear and saying, we've got to do something, even if it wasn't working. But they felt they had to do something. I think right now the embargo is not working. We should loosen it up. This is my personal opinion. We should loosen it up, but there are other forms, there are other things that could be done. It could also be used as a bargaining tool in a way. But as it is, if you remember a long time ago, there was a great play called The Mouse That Roared, which a small power needed a bugaboo so they could go ahead and rouse the people. And this has been, for the Cuban government, their little bugaboo, the embargo. And as long as they have the embargo, they'll go ahead and use that to unite forces against the United States.
Let's get rid
of that.
Yeah. Let's go to a few calls about this. And we need to point out, while this isn't Miami, or even Central Florida, there is a vibrant Cuban-American diaspora here in our area. They did take part in protests over the weekend downtown. The U.S. has imposed sanctions and embargoes on Cuba since the Eisenhower administration. Last month, a convoy of Cuban diplomats went to the United Nations to call the ongoing U.S. embargo an act of war. Okay, 549-2937. Eduardo in Clay County. Eduardo, good morning.
Good morning. I happen to be someone who have debated publicly in universities. Last time I did it was in First Coast Law School here a few years ago. Cuban government official from what at that time was the Cuban interest section and from the United Nations Cuban embassy. And one of the questions, of course, that came up was the embargo. I asked the Cuban government official to name any item, one, necessary for the Cuban economy that Cuba could not get somewhere else for cheaper, about the same price than here, or maybe between 5 to 10% difference on the price. They could not name me one thing. If we go to our own Walmarts and Home Depots here, and we look around, you're going to see half the stuff is not even made in the United States anyway. And the problem with Cuba is not the embargo from the U.S. And by the way, there's no embargo when it comes to food, medicine, and interestingly enough, because it falls under agriculture, wood, lumber, as an example. The problem with Cuba is that they do not pay. They have the worst, maybe perhaps second to North Korea, record in the entire planet of paying their debts. So nobody wants to loan them any money. Now, some business in the United States wants to do business because we have a guarantee on exports to
Let me ask you then, Eduardo. Yeah. Do you support the embargo continuing in light of these new protests, or do you think that the U.S. should reconsider?
Completely support. This is why we have the uprising in Cuba. The problem with it is that when we send something to Cuba, Cuba is a gigantic funnel controlled by the government. The government controls all anything that comes in. They suck out of it whatever they want to, and whatever is left, they decide who gets it. And the order of people who gets it is first themselves, the high government officials, then their supporters, and then what's left is distributed to the people under the name of the revolution, like they got it for them.
So what I hear you saying is even if we ended the embargo, it might not help the people a whole lot?
It will continue to priority number one for the Cuban government, obviously, is to keep themselves in power.
Yeah.
They will not do anything that will risk them losing power.
And
that's including economics.
And Ed, I so appreciate you calling in because I know you live down in Fleming Island and of course you have informed opinions about Cuba. You're a Cuban American. And there are quite a few of you out there. Give us a call if you're listening. Mario, what about Ed's points?
I think he makes a great point. And Ed definitely sounds like, you know, he understands what's happening right now. And unfortunately, you know, by hurting the people, it has caused this uprising and they have been motivated to say something. But the truth is that we've already seen what happens in Latin American countries. The people's voices are not important to those in power. We need a political intervention. And you know what's funny is that in China, you know, we were so afraid of China becoming communist and becoming this military force. And what did we do to get those people to start becoming more empowered? We went and built factories there. We went and started building products there. We started, you know, and then that helped people create a sort of pseudo-democracy, you know, and right now in Cuba, we took a whole different perspective. You know, we're not trying to invest in that country. We're not trying to build the people up. We're really just putting them out.
Chad, what about that? Should the U.S. be engaged in economic development in Cuba?
Well, it's definitely a good bargaining tool, but at the same time, we cannot use China as an example because in China, what's happened is, yes, the government is still strong. It is still a dictatorship, and you cannot think. And this is a big problem in Cuba. Cuba is very independent. And There's been a big, how can I say, black market economy going through, but it's still, it's drying up. The government of Cuba right now only has one main objective, staying in power. That's all. And they'll use whatever to stay in power. The embargo is just an excuse now. They'll say other things, one thing after the other. They don't have the economic power to be another China, although the Cuban people could definitely would love to have factories and whatever, but they're still not going to reap the benefits. It's still, like Eduardo said, it's a big funnel for the communist group that runs the everything there. Whatever's left over, then it goes to the people, and it's very, very little, very little.
It's 549-2937, and here's an email from a listener. If the Cuban dictatorship should fall, Jacksonville would return to being the number one port for bulk imports to Cuba. It would make Cuba the number one client for Jaxport. Mario, you know, Florida's relationship to Cuba is a unique one. And as I mentioned earlier, we're not Miami, but there are threads that extend all the way up here to North Florida and people that have so much invested in this, in our area.
Oh, yeah, I mean, we have very strong Cuban roots. The first leaders, the first Hispanic leaders here in Jacksonville are Cubans. You know, the our most well-known families here in Jacksonville are Cubans, and they help established a strong, you know, prominent foothold here, and they were literally the leaders of the Hispanic voice here in Jacksonville, and continue being that. And you know, and I'm very proud of all the hard work our Cuban leaders have done here in Jacksonville. And I know that with that stronghold, as soon as we do open those gates, we have the connections here in Jacksonville. We have all our leadership in place to make something wonderful. I do hope that happens. And I hope that our current leadership sees that what's going on right now isn't working, and backing Cuba up into a corner is not the answer. We have to get more creative.
Melissa, if I may speak a second, I don't think that the problem so much is the embargo. And again, the embargo is again being used as a tool, but the main problem here is the lack of resources in Cuba at this moment. If there's no food, and this has happened before in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, there are what they call special periods, as happens in all these communist countries. It's a special period, everybody's got to tighten their belt, blah, 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 and it still stays the same. If there's no food and the cats start disappearing from the neighborhood, and it's a serious thing, it does happen. People do eat the cats. People have told me about this. It gets so bad that they don't know what to eat. And this is a country that used to be so rich, but the embargo is I think it's a small part of it. Right now, these demonstrations are demonstrations of support here in Jacksonville and in Miami, because the solution to all this has to come from within Cuba. Cubans themselves in the island, and here I'm talking with a Cuban outside of the island. I came when I was 9 years old. Mm-hmm. I've not gone back. I don't think I can go back because I have the same name as my father. My father's name is Charles. Same as me, and it would be a lot of problems. But within Cuba right now, fear, hunger, and lack of opportunity, and also lack of free speech. Although that's
I mean, you have to really recognize how extreme it must be for that many Cubans to take to the streets and risk their very lives like that. Yeah, I mean, there's no free speech there. They don't demonstrate the way we do. Let me get a few callers on. Curtis on the north side. Curtis, go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. I support the Cuban people and their efforts, but I think it's kind of ironic that here we are in the United States and we got the same mentality here, what your guest said. The people there in charge want to hold on to power. Well, we got a group of people here that want to deny everyone the right to vote because they what? They want to stay in power. Thank you so much.
Curtis, thanks for that. You know, it's interesting, Mario. In our next segment here on the show, we will be talking about voting rights. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis put out a statement expressing solidarity with the Cuban people and their right to protest. Critics immediately hammered him for pointing out that he pushed into law a measure in Florida that critics say will criminalize protest. So is there some hypocrisy on the part of some political figures in this country when they make statements about Cuba that conflict with their own actions here stateside?
Well, it's interesting, Melissa. It's times like these when we see things in other countries that our leaders see the importance of allowing people to have a political voice, of having freedom of speech. And I hope that our leaders, like our governor, can start thinking about some of the choices that they're making and seeing how our country cannot be like these other countries. We need to continue to respect our Constitution and respect people's rights.
Ricardo emails the show, "We should be concerned with how the repeal of the wet foot, dry foot policy could be a factor if the regime's answer is pushing folks out if we have another Mariel Boatlift. Cubans need support in pursuit of freedom," he says. Let's take one more call. It's Jorge in Ponte Vedra. Jorge, you're on the air. Go ahead.
You remove that even on a trial basis.
Go ahead, Jorge.
Yeah, hey, I just wanted to mention the embargo has been going on for 60 years. It hasn't helped. The number one thing the president of Cuba said the problem stemmed from was the embargo. So take away the excuse. Once you remove the excuse and the country is still not functioning, then the government has no more excuse, and the people can rise up and the people can say, stop with this, because it's you, it's not the embargo. They use the embargo as the panacea. Oh, if we didn't have the embargo, this place would be great, but it's just because of the embargo.
Okay.
Remove it, it's only temporary, and you'll see.
Jorge, thanks. Chad, can the people rise up and overthrow this government? It's an oppressive regime that has lasted for couple of generations now.
Well, it has to do, because it cannot come from the outside. We used to talk about the Monroe Doctrine to be able to invade Cuba and defend it. But Monroe Doctrine talks about when an exterior force comes and takes over the country. Now, when it's from the inside, when it's the actual government itself, the United States has no legal way to invade, to do something. Now, it's really ironic, because for many years, my father, who had been with Castro, my father was Castro's friend when they were 10 years old, and during college and whatever. And like most Cubans during the 50s, they arose against the dictatorship of Batista, and they did it militarily, and they put their efforts behind Castro because they wanted to get rid of that situation. But Castro came along and used fear. He put in secret police all over the place, and people cannot talk anymore. People cannot express them. And for many years, he held them down this way. The best thing that we can do right now is support the people who are protesting. When the FBI used to go into my dad's office, my dad was a dentist in New Jersey, and we'd go into his office to look around and see what was going on, because they said, and I found these reports on the internet, that my father and other Cubans were collecting money to buy arms to go invade Cuba. This is back in the 70s, by the way. But the FBI didn't want that, because there are laws against arising, against supporting revolutions in this country. It's against the law, and we were not allowed to support. But within the country of Cuba, I think Cubans here and around the world, we should support them as locally as we can. That's all.
All righty.
That's all we can do.
Chad Dominicis, President, General Manager of TU18 Jax TV and TU18Jax.com. Mario DiCunto, past Chair of the Mayor's Hispanic American Advisory Board. Gentlemen, thank you both so much for joining us.
You're welcome, and thank you.
Appreciate it.
And much more still ahead. Later in the hour, author Tim Gilmore. But up next,
Georgia made it easier to vote, and then immediately after that happened, the Republican-controlled state government stepped in to crack down on it.
Well, and that's one version of the story that gets told.
It's common these days, family members disagreeing on politics. We'll drop in on a conversation with one prominent local family, the Delaneys. That's next. Well, we live in a polarized era, so much so, in fact, that disagreements over the top issues of the day are increasingly leading to family feuds. The Pew Research Center reports political polarization is more intense now than at any point in modern history. It's tearing family relationships, friendships apart. But one local family does try to navigate their disagreements with love and respect. Former Jacksonville mayor and UNF president John Delaney is a conservative. His son, Bill Delaney, an editor at our partner, The Jackson, is far more progressive than his dad. They disagree often, but both say they enjoy the give and take. They like to talk about all of the issues, including one that is salient right now, voting rights. President Joe Biden is delivering a speech on voting rights in Philadelphia this afternoon as states like Texas are seeking to restrict ballot access and progressives want federal protections. Texas Democrats actually fled the state this week rather than go back into session and approve voting restrictions. So here is John and Bill Delaney discussing voting rights and ballot security. Take a listen.
Last year, Georgia really kind of opened things up, made it easier to vote, and the result was a very high turnout and then a series of victories for Democrats. And then immediately after that happened, the Republican-controlled state government stepped in to crack down on it.
Well, and that's one version of the story that gets told by a lot of the media. What Georgia did for the 2020 election was mailed everybody in the state an absentee ballot. Everybody. And they had a series of drop boxes where you could drop those ballots off. And I actually went over the Georgia law and then compared it to New Jersey and New York and Colorado. There's a number of articles that have kind of dissected it. And the reforms that they were doing was saying we can't have any kind of ballot security if everybody has an absentee ballot and we can't validate that they're legitimate ballots. And the location of the drop boxes kind of invite potential fraud, which is another criticism that comes in from the left is quote, no evidence of voter fraud.
Yeah, that's the thing, is they are basing this off of voter fraud claims that the state of Georgia itself admits just did not happen in the last election.
Well,
and that was under pressure from the president to try to change things. They stood firm and they said, no, we don't have evidence of fraud. The Democrats won fair and square. Biden won. Warnock won. Ossoff won.
Well, I don't have evidence of a burglary at my house, but I still lock the doors at night. And I think you and Katie do the same thing. And the opportunity for fraud is what the worry would be. I had three or four absentee ballots to other people that were mailed to my house or dropped in the mailbox that I could very easily have voted for those individuals and scribbled their name on there. And there's no way to really validate. I mean, we've got just lay people looking. Is that the same signature that we have on file? And I think the thing that people don't really understand what that Georgia law did, and I realize why there's some angst over it because of the history primarily in the South of taking away people's or restricting people's right to vote. But, you know, I kind of go to check into a hotel, I have to show a driver's license. To get an airplane, I have to show a driver's license. To do anything at a bank, I've got to show a driver's license. And the most sacred right in a democracy is to be able to vote. So the counterargument is typically not everybody can get a driver's license or...
Oh, yeah, that's... Yeah, how do you... You know, if that's true... You know, everybody ought to be able to prove who they are to do all of these things. How do you explain the fact that there's such a disparity between African Americans and white people?
Well, what has not been really out there, though, is that Georgia doesn't require that. They say you can use a Social Security number. You can use a utility bill that has your name and address on it. Just something with a scintilla of proof that you are who you say you are and you live where you say you're supposed to live so that you're in the right precinct or congressional district and that kind of a thing. And I haven't seen that covered at all, that you can use a utility bill or a lease, copy of a lease, got your name. Doesn't even have to be a photo ID, just something so that people in good faith know that you are who you say you are.
Okay, but still there's a discrepancy because it's happened in, you know, every previous election where they had requirements like that you had to have proof. I mean, to me, the discrepancy is the bigger issue, you know, and that's what we ought to be solving. We shouldn't, you know, punish voters for not having the stuff. We should be making sure that they, you know, that they have it, that they have access to the ballot.
Well, I don't think I disagree with that, but what does discrepancy mean to you?
It means that, you know, various folks who have studied this have said that it's going to primarily affect African Americans and other minorities, or disproportionately affect them compared to white people.
To be able to produce an electric bill?
Yeah. I mean, regardless of what it is, the discrepancy is there.
Well, I mean, we're about as open in being able to vote as any place in the entire world, and there's early voting, and there's absentee voting, and there's day of registrations. And I know the point you often make is that the Georgia reforms have made it harder to vote than it was in 2020, but it still is significantly easier than it was in 2016. They just kind of threw open the doors for 2020. There's more early voting days in Georgia than New York, New Jersey, or Colorado. There's more permissive forms of identification. You can write your Social Security number on the absentee ballot. What more can you do?
Well, here's the thing. You mentioned New York and New Jersey being more restrictive. The thing is, they didn't change their laws to be more restrictive as a result of a party that they didn't like winning a bunch of elections. It's just the way that it has been there.
But you're letting the motivation distract from the results. I mean, if you read the statute, it's just not that bad. I mean, it really isn't. It's not, in my mind, in the way it's been portrayed in a lot of the media.
I just feel that if you're going to change a law, if you're going to make a change that makes it more difficult to vote, there ought to be a very good reason. And I just don't think that the specter of potential future fraud in some future election is good enough for me and for a lot of people.
I maybe worry more about fraud because I've run for office. And you know, the pattern in Jacksonville was the story was that machine politicians would wrap a $5 bill around a half pint of whiskey and with a piece of paper, you know, saying who to vote for, and then load people into buses and drive them down. And the potential's there. Just saying it hasn't happened in the immediate past doesn't mean that groups aren't going to try to stuff those drop boxes and, you know, fill out absentee ballots for people. You know, your grandmother, I mean, I could have filled a ballot out for her and turned it in before she passed away. It's too easy to do.
Well, I mean, the other thing that they used to do back then was restricting the vote and coming up with all sorts of laws to make sure that certain parties, certain candidates, or certain ethnic groups were, I mean, effectively disenfranchised.
No question. But what does that have to do with showing an ID or writing your Social Security number on an absentee ballot or turning in an electric bill?
I'm saying that if there is, you know, a potential for fraud, there's also potential for restriction, especially restriction that you kind of hide by, you know, making sure that it fits the letter of the law.
Well, what would you do about ballot security?
I mean, I would do what they did in 2020 until there is evidence that something is wrong. I mean, I'm usually in favor of more people voting and more people having access to the franchise and more people being engaged in politics.
Yeah, but I guess really the fundamental difference we have is people are going to cheat if it's that easy to do, if it's easy to just write somebody else's name on a ballot and send it in with no real way to validate it. I just don't understand why the left isn't concerned with that. I just don't get it. I mean, I'm haunted too by the Jim Crow laws and the, you know, the poll taxes and those kinds of things. Even the Georgia senators say you've got to have some kind of identity, and 80% of the public thinks that's true. Now, you don't do a poll on some fundamental rights, but I mean, I think the common sense argument is there's a concern that people are going to vote for others.
Yeah, I think that part of the issue there is the credibility that the people who made these changes have. And the timing of it coming after three elections swung for Democrats, then all of a sudden this Republican governor and Republican-controlled legislature made these changes that are, I mean, it's just a fact that it's going to affect Democrats more. including people who voted in 2020 that, you know, probably didn't vote in 2016 for one reason or another.
Yeah, I don't know if I know that for sure or not. I guess the motivations don't really matter. To me, it's the black letter of the law, and that may be another set of differences. Is that I kind of am with the Scalia Clarence Thomas wing of the U.S. Supreme Court. Go to the letter of the law, not the intent of Congress in passing some of these bills.
Yeah, I think that is probably another area that we disagree on.
Well, you know, I guess we break down on a concern over security and your concern over historic voting restrictions, and that the legal phrase would be, is there going to be a disparate impact on poor and African-American voters? And I just don't know how to make it any more open than Georgia's got, which is still more open than New York or New Jersey. And there, you know, the motivation is to drive up the constituency of Democrats to turn out.
And I do understand what you're saying. I'm just, you know, as a student of history and native-born Southerner, you know, I just get real wary when people start taking away voting rights.
Yeah. So you think that the 2020 rules, which is everybody gets an absentee ballot, I guess you're okay with an element of risk that there's going to be some fraud going on?
Yeah, I mean, and if it turns out in some future election that there is fraud, then try to fix it then or do something else. I mean, I'm, again, in favor of more people getting the franchise and more people getting involved in civil society and in politics. I think, like, in the future, technology is going to advance to the point that you won't need to bring in ID. You know, you'll just be able to prove who you are just by being there or even doing it online.
As usual, we're not very far apart, just kind of on one side of the line, and we're far away from where one of your grandfathers was, who felt that anybody that got a check from the government shouldn't be allowed to vote. He felt that they were biased and had a conflict of interest. And I don't know if he felt that way once he started getting Social Security or not.
Thank you, Bill Delaney, editor at the Jackson Mag, our news partner, and John Delaney, his dad, former mayor, former president of UNF, and they will continue the conversation later this summer. Speaking of summer, it's a time to catch up on some great books. We have some ideas for summer reads, reader's block, and more from our own Stacy Goldring. It's this month's book club. Hey, Stacy.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. So you have reader's block this summer?
You know, it's been kind of on and off, but I have a solution. So that's what I'm excited to share with everyone
great.
This morning.
I need it too.
Okay. Well, here you go. So I have 3 points to make, and all three of these should be incredibly helpful. First of all, what I did was I tried something different. So I found a book, it's poetry, and it's called But She Still Flies, and it's actually by some local authors, Emma Greenhill and Jenny Noble Anderson. And Melissa, it's a beautiful book about resilience, and you not only are you inspired by the prose, but Melissa, the artwork in it reminds me of like Gustav Klimt. It's beautiful. And I'd say the style of the poems is kind of like Mary Oliver. It's almost one of those books, and I would never do this, but you know, you could almost cut out the pictures and frame them. It's a stunning book. And I know you can find it online or on Facebook at But Still She Flies. And also the authors, I understand, are going to be at the Riverside Arts Market on the 24th. So I love supporting local authors.
Yeah.
So that's But She Still Flies, and that's poetry. Secondly, and this was very helpful, I revisited an author, and I rarely do this because there's so many books out there, but I decided, you know, Amor Towles wrote Rules of Civility and A Gentleman in Moscow, and he has a new book out. It's not out till October 5th, but I was able to see a preview copy. How lucky is that? And the name of the book is called The Lincoln Highway, okay? So this book brings us back to 1954. Here we are. It's summer in Nebraska. And after the death of their father, these two brothers, the elder has just finished serving time in a work farm. They plan to start a new life. They're going to do a road trip, hop in the car, and go to California. But as they take the Lincoln Highway west, they end up taking a detour because they find out that two friends have hidden themselves in the trunk of the car, which is a Studebaker. So instead of California, they're going to New York City.
Oh, hello.
Yeah. So this is typical. I don't know if you've read Amor Towles yet, and if you haven't, I highly recommend this author. But I would call this typical Towles style. The structure is built around incredibly interesting characters. It's a multi-layered plot that unfolds kind of like origami, literally, over 10 days. He's also very mathematically minded, this author, so everything has a great structure. It's kind of like a calming version of either Candide or Mice and Men. We get to meet hobos, a Wizard of Oz character. We're at burlesque shows. We're in Harlem. We're in New York society. We're at the top of the Empire State Building. We're in the Adirondacks. And we get to go to Howard Johnson's and order a meal. And remember Hojo's and going there when you take a road trip, like on the Ohio Turnpike? Remember? Oh my gosh, so much fun. So anyway, it's very nostalgic. And here's the big news. He's coming back to Jacksonville November 15th, and tickets are just now going on sale. You have to go.
Oh, that's a hot ticket.
Oh yeah, this is news. So he is going to be in Jax on November 15th. And if you go to San Marco Books, they're bringing him in. If you go to their Facebook page, you can order the book and the ticket. And it sold out when he was here for Gentlemen in Moscow. And they packed, the Baptist church on the corner. They sold over 700 seats. So I would say, you know, reserve early. And the best way, you know what I'm going to say next, to alleviate reader's block, Melissa, is you join a book club.
And tell everyone in the short time we have left how they can join our book club here on the show, which you lead.
You go to chapterendnotes.com and you sign up now for fall, and we'll be reading together starting in September, and I'd love to see you all there. You too, Melissa, because I know you have so much time on your hands.
So chapterendnotes.com,
right.
Or email Stacy at bookclub@wjct.org. If you missed anything she said about this month's recommended books, more about any more tolls coming to town this fall, whatever questions you have, bookclub@wjct.org. Get out there and read. Stacy Goldring, leading us into literacy every month on this show for years now. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Speaking of books, in a moment, we speak with First Coast author Tim Gilmore about his new book, looking into the fascinating history of this city's violent past and present. That's next.
Business Results LLC is committed to helping you coach your teams to their potential. Business Results is the only firm in the U.S. that combines the power of the predictive index with the insights of Cotill. BusinessResultsLLC.com.
MoveDay, a Suttoth company, is dedicated to providing personalized and dependable local moving services in the Jacksonville area. MoveDay's team of professional movers provides quotes and real-time move tracking technology. More info at MoveDayMover.com.
I'm Don Gagne. Irish writer Susan McKay thinks that Northern Ireland created 100 years ago by Great Britain might not last another 10 years. She joins us to talk Brexit, the scrambling of old divides, and talk of reunification. That story and an update on the situation in Haiti, next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about Facebook, the problems it's created, and the problems it's facing. My guests will be New York Times reporters Shira Frankel and Cecilia Kang, authors of the new book, An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. They write, Facebook's problems have been features, not bugs. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
A summer sprint is about to get underway, one that has nothing to do with the Olympics. Lawmakers are returning to Washington for a crucial session, one with the potential to make or break political legacies. We'll look at what's at stake in the race to get deals done on infrastructure, voting rights, and guide you through the legislative gymnastics. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Professor Tim Gilmore has done it again. His new book, Murder Capital, examines the fascinating history of Jacksonville's violent past and present. Gilmore speaks about the book Thursday at the Jacksonville Historical Society. Here's a preview. Hey, Tim. Good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. Good to speak with you as well.
So you've done it again. Written yet another fascinating book. You're incredibly prolific. I always say that when we have you on, because you're on so frequently. You turn out books every, it seems like, every other month. Tell us about Murder Capital. This is unfortunately about Jacksonville, but it's a fascinating right. story or series of stories.
Yeah. Well, this actually began 8 years ago when I did a talk at the Jacksonville Historical Society, and at the time, this was 2013, my book about Otis Toole was just coming out, and Emily Liska, who was president of the Historical Society at the time, said, you could give a talk, but talking about Otis Toole might be too dark. Why don't you do the history of murder in Jacksonville? I've always kind of thought that was funny, because that's pretty dark. Some of what I talked about that night, which was on Halloween, by the way, 2013, stuck with me, and I wanted to research it further, and that ended up with becoming this book, which actually came out last year, but that was during the pandemic. And the Historical Society is having their first live gathering since the pandemic the 15th. Yeah.
That's good to hear. So this will be a great attraction for people to gather there in the first time in over a year. You're going to be reading from the book. And these are some little known stories from this city. Is that right?
Yeah, some fascinating stories. Some of them are better known than others. I did talk to Shelton Chappelle, who is the youngest son of Johnny May Chappelle, who was murdered in 1964. Unfortunately, famous, infamous story of racial injustice that happened here. Other stories are not nearly so well known. And others, I think, are people know bits and pieces of them, but they're misunderstood. So there's the famous because there was a sensational trial that followed, a murder of a girl named Marie-Louise Gatto in Springfield in the 1890s. And a lot of people know about it. Her father owned El Modelo, a cigar factory. The building is still there downtown. It's a beautiful brick building. So there was all kinds of intrigue and possible connections to Cuban revolutionaries. Her family actually brought the revolutionary Jose Martí to town to speak at El Modelo several times. And a couple of her alleged fiancés had traveled aboard gunrunners to Havana. There was a sensational trial. Women Strangely, wrote love notes to the main person who was accused and sent flowers to his jail cell. And this was in the middle of the summer in the courthouse, and women, the newspapers wrote of this. Women swooned left and right. Of course, it was also like 100 degrees. And if you think about how women dressed in the 1890s,
yeah,
that may have had something to do with it. And it ended with this 6 hour long closing speech by his defense attorney, and that speech ended with his attorney being the last person to pass out in the trial. So the whole thing just very sensational, and I think people have known bits and pieces about it for years. I don't think anybody's written the whole story about it before.
Well, we can count on you for that, because you've written so many great books about this area. You're a great writer, but you're really a historian too, because you do your research and you bring local history alive. What motivates you to keep doing that in such an artful way?
Yeah, thank you. It's interesting because I don't consider myself a historian. I'm an English major. I mean, I have a PhD in English, but you know, that's how I align myself. But, you know, the research is, it's a form of archaeology almost, and it's captivating, and digging into the newspaper stories and trying to find what buildings are still there, trying to find, you know, connections that maybe nobody has made before. Those kinds of things are so much fun. I mean, they're captivating, you know, so it's easy to become obsessive about these kinds of stories.
Well, I'm sure it's going to be a great crowd coming out to see you on the 15th at the Historical Society to hear more from your book. Now, it's free, but people are asked to donate and sign up to register to attend, correct?
Yeah, right. So, and if you are a member of the Jacksonville Historical Society, then it is certainly free to you. And donations of $10 are requested. So, you know, it would be the polite thing to do. And, of course, it would be going to a good cause.
That's right. Tim Gilmore, have fun with it. And everybody check out the new book, Murder Capital. Thanks, Tim.
All right. Thanks.
And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Catch our podcast up later today wherever you like to listen. You can also listen right through the WJCT app. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.